Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I am proud to bring you Spaced Out, part of our legacy shows, and I'm very honored to have Bob Bosler here. Greetings and welcome, Bob. How are you, sir?
Doing good. A little congested, but other than that, I'm feeling fine, and I'm ready to roll with tonight's episode.
Fantastic. Your guest appears to be here, so I'll be in the background in case you need me.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Hey, Ted.
How you all doing today?
Pretty
good.
All right.
Pretty good. Where do you want to start at?
I was looking back to our subject of the day. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, I can.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Look, got you on a kind of a speaker box thing just to make it easier. I was looking to refresh my memory on our subject of today, which is, of course, Star Blazers and other associated anime, because you are
definitely in that. Recently,
and
the creator of Star Blazers recently, or Space Battleship Yamato, he also did some other anime. His name was Leiji Matsumoto. He was from Japan. He did the Arcadia series, or Captain Harlock, Space Pirate Harlock. I think he was involved with the Cosmo Zero anime, which was kind of attached to the Captain Harlock saga. And then Queen Esmeralda, that was another one he did. And then he also did Galaxy Express. They were all kind of like connected to each other because the characters shared similar designs, similar background stories. And it was a very big influence for young people in the late 70s, early 80s, that also got them into science fiction, anime, and, you know, Star Trek and the other stuff. You know, it was kind of like a foot in the door kind of thing for the young people that were like, you know, young kids that would get up every morning and watch these shows, you know, when they were on. I think mostly Space Battleship Yamato or Star Blazers.
My own time, remembering it was on like Channel 11, New York in 1979. I think that's when I first saw it coming back from school, you know, because this music kind of brought back memories here, you know.
That was
and it tells
the
whole
song.
Narrative too, you know.
Yeah. I know recently they redid the entire series, and they've been re-releasing it on Blu-ray, DVD, but it's an adaptation, like the Ron Moore Battlestar Galactica reimagined. They've done it with the anime. It's much crisper, the detail. The characters are more lifelike, and they still have the traditional sorrow and love stories that occur in you know, that anime genre. And it's beautifully done. The redesign of the ship, it's pretty much the same ship. They just simply changed a few things. I'll give an example. If you were to look at the forward section of the ship and the front gun turret, on a model from the 80s and then a model of the ship today, there's things called runners, which ran alongside the sides of the turrets. And they both provided an aerodynamic effect on the ship as a lifting body when it was entering an atmosphere, and they protected the turrets from shear forces, like wind forces that could shear them off. And they acted as armor plates for the base of the turrets. Now, these were deleted in the live-action film, and it carried over to the reimagined anime as a result. So there's pros and cons to the deletion of those runners. The deck's a little wider, so you don't have to worry about atmospheric shearing forces. The ship is a little bit longer and more proportioned better, I think. But the giveaway is now you're losing that armor protection that used to be there at the base of the turrets that would protect the mechanisms. But, you know, in science fiction, that's the fun of it. You know, you can be creative and inventive. An example would be if somebody went to my Facebook page and looked up Ted Athanasio, they would find my build pictures of my own space battleships I do. And if they were to ask me the technical stats on them, yeah, they look like space battleships, but they're different in that I use technologies from different universes, you know, to enhance them, you know. And that could be stuff like if you look at some of my ships, they have these gold pieces on them. Those are phaser strips, for example. That's from Star Trek. You know, they're torpedo launchers, just don't launch torpedoes. They launch quantum torpedoes and they self-replicate. Once again, Star Trek technology. But yet they have the BSG or Battlestar Galactica jump drive instead of a warp drive. You know, and then for navigation, they would use the Mimbari navigation system from Babylon 5. So when you look at my stats of my ships, they're built differently than the ships from Space Battleship Yamato, but they're influenced, you know, on originality of where they or their origin was, where they came from. And when I build these models, I do them in 1/350 scale. They're very big pieces of art. They're pieces of art. When I build models, it's art.
They definitely are. You do a fantastic job. I've seen from over the years. I may not know what they're actually from. They are, I can tell you, you put all the detail of them in there and then modify them a little bit, you know, to suit your own creation.
Here's another example. Here's another example, not to cut you off. Here's another example of modification. Emily has one. There's one hanging up in Hobbytown, Tom Driller, the Alyssa Travis. And then Emily has her ship named for her. You know, those are Blue Star class heavy destroyers. They are based off of Deep Space Nine's Defiant class. And the only difference between them and the Defiant is the amount of sheer firepower. When you look at those ships and you look at the tops and on the bottoms, you'll see these little look like checkerboards. They're hatches. They're designed to open up and vertically launch self-replicating torpedoes. Where did I get the vertical launch idea? I didn't get it from the U.S. Navy. I got it from the space battleship Yamato because they had horizontal torpedoes under the anti-aircraft guns, and then they had the forward and aft horizontal torpedo tubes, and then they had launching tubes in the smokestack that were vertical, and that's where I got the idea from. I just simply used the same design the U.S. Navy does for its vertical launch system. But the origin of that comes from Space Battleship Yamato, in my mind. That's where I got it from. So that's just an example of how something translated from that into Star Trek onto a ship design. And then a lot of other things from the ship vary from, you know, different universes once again. Like on the bottom of the ship, there's a bomb bay. There's FLIR pods for low-level flights that can fly in an atmosphere. There's the mech bay, which doesn't hold shuttlecraft, holds Gundams instead. Well, there's something from Gundam, you know, another anime that's associated with what I do. So these are just examples of some of the ideas of how I cross things because I thought it would be cool to do them. And I've actually had a lot of positive encouragement by people to keep doing them, you know. And it's been a lot of fun. You know, unfortunately, I've got some health issues at the moment, and I'm trying to cope with that. So my model building's not as big as it once was.
Ted, what is the basic storyline, though, of the, at the core of Battleship Yamato Star Blazers? You know, like, but
okay, so the first storyline to answer that, it's very good. The first storyline is Earth was under attack by another civilization called the Gamelons, and they needed Earth for a new home because their home world is kind of like really dying. And so they were trying to – it was kind of like if you ever watched Man of Steel was what General Zod was doing. Basically, I think that was a ripoff from Space Battleship Yamato, but it was a very good one. I don't put it down. It was well done. It fits Superman perfectly, you know, the Man of Steel film with Henry Cavill. It worked out. Mm-hmm. So I call it a ripoff because it's probably, you know, I'm sure they came up with it on their own, but, you know, it's a whole thing of, anyway, the whole premise, not to get off subject, the whole premise was Earth is on its last legs, and as a desperate move, they were originally going to use the Yamato to evacuate people. They got the engine technology from another world, which later turns out to be the sister planet to Gamelon called Iskandar. And Iskandar and Gamelon are twin worlds that orbit each other and orbit a star. And but they differ in contrasts of handling situations. And so the Iskandarians send the warp technology for the Yamato. And in the process of building, they realize they have way too much power, and they decide they can use the excess power for the main gun they create, which makes the ship, like, really powerful. I mean, technology idea was Tsunami. She sits in the Ralston Library in Ralston, Nebraska, on permanent display as a museum ship. Tsunami
oh, wow.
was so powerful with a wave motion gun. She was number three on the list to be built. We only built her as a prototype. But the gun is so powerful. I had some friends playing it stats in a dice game. They said not only did it take out 30 Borg cubes in one shot and a dozen planets, it blew up an entire star so violently that it destroyed the gravity well as though the star was never there. And it did it at only 4.5% capacity of the total capacity of a gun. So that's like 1,000 space battleship Yamatos put together firing a wave motion gun simultaneously at full power.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's why only one was built, and it was, you know, plus there were economic reasons. I mean, it was a big ship. The closest things that exist right now to Tsunami are the Gina Carano, which Damien has, and then you have the sister ship, the Michelle Rodriguez and Mothballs.
Hmm.
And for PR purposes, we only keep one active so that if you have an event going on, we can bring one. The other one we keep inactive. That also has to do with our agreement with, you know, both with Region 7, Integrity, at the time the Klingon Iron Fist Battle Fleet, the Romulan groups that existed back in the 90s, and even Starfleet Marines. What I refer to sometimes on my postings on Facebook as the Murray Grove Treaty, and that was my group, Galinchica, which later became Cambria, would not build space battleships over a certain size, and then they would curb them if they were too powerful. So the Carano class is like a watered-down version of Tsunami, so it's not as powerful. Tsunami was overkill. It was a god syndrome, and I decided that I would base the other ships on its advances, but not the weaponry power would be watered down, because it was going to be in violation of the agreement. That's also why I don't build out of 1/350 scale. I stay in 1/200 scale. We can build prototypes for research, which I've done, but we don't go over a certain size, because then we've got monster ships that are hard to move and display, and so to make it easier, we have a size limitation. It's just like the naval treaties, you know, between World Wars I and World War II.
Yeah.
So it's historical reference. So you see where history plays in, too, on some of what I do, you know, and what Damien does. And, you know, I kind of wish Damien was on with us tonight, because it would be a lot of fun, because but he's, you know, got some health issues himself, and it makes it difficult for him to be up certain times of the day. So, but anyway, continuing on, what other questions you got, Bob, you know?
Well, to some of these races, you had mentioned that in some of the other anime series, that is there are sometimes crossovers or some of the same alien antagonists or protagonists, do they show up in other series or are they referenced?
The other series done by Lee Jai Matsumoto, yes. There was crossovers between Spaced and Harlock, or the Arcadia series, and Queen Esmeralda. There was one brief flash moment of the Kairu from, I believe, Cosmo Zero. It had a moment where Space Battleship Yamato and the Arcadia were featured together.
It
was like a real quick clipping. It was the only real connection. Cosmo Zero was kind of connected to more so Captain Harlock series, because it really involved the Arcadia, Captain Harlock, and the captain of the Karu, I forget his name, And the Karu was a battleship of what was known as the Independent Fleet. It was a very unusual design, but it was a very elegant design. I actually kind of liked it. Unlike the KJ Enterprise, which I was glad to see destroyed, and then they built the Enterprise A. I'm sorry, all you J.J. Abrams fans of that Calvin universe. I love the crew, love the actors and the characters, but I hated that gaudy, ugly, disgusting-looking Enterprise. It was gross.
Yeah, it looked like a radio show.
Classic. Again, there were copyright issues at the time involved that caused it. So I don't blame the creators. It's not their fault. Yeah. It's the lawyers.
Although I will say that the Kelvinverse they had the reverse problem. They had everything so brightly lit, whereas now, as much as I love the current season of Picard, I wish someone would light up the bridge here and there. I understand when they're into battle or if they're at a scene where there's a seedy bar, which there has been in both cases, but every scene seems to be very dark, and I do remember the Kelvinverse was almost the opposite.
I think,
so brightly, looked like
I'm
a radio shack store.
I think Battlestar Galactica influenced that, the reimagined series, in the sense of how the shows have become dark in some ways and more tense. The lighting effects are different. They've done their own version of lighting effects, which actually I think it's kind of cool. It's a little bit darker. I would like to see more bridge detail. Yes, I agree. There should be, at certain times, a little more illumination. Another influence from Battlestar Galactica was, I'd mentioned our Blue Star Destroyers were based on the Defiance. There's another crossover of technology. When we built Galaxy-class ships, better yet, for an example, the Galaxy-class, this is a better example. Our Galaxy-class ships are based on, the Star Trek ones. They're basically the same kit. What we have on paper is a ship that's twice the size, can do more, has atmospheric flight capability, reduced crew of 500, carries a lot of fighters, and a lot of firepower, a lot more. It doesn't have windows. Those windows are recessed anti-aircraft batteries. Jem'Hadar attack ships, good example of what you want to stop coming at you. But where they differ is the bridge location. Cosmetically they look the same other than they're twice the size of the Enterprise D, for example. So the Enterprise D with its saucer would only be the size of the engineering hull. But the biggest difference is the bridge is not on top of the saucer. That is a lounge. There's no bridge up there. It's an easy target. The bridge is buried.
I've always wondered about that. You're going to put that as your right on top, of course that's...
Yeah, so as an influence, the bridge, even on my space battleships, when you look at the space battleships, that's not a bridge. That's an observation deck. That's all it is. The actual bridge on the space battleships and on my on the Galaxy-class ships that we were building for many years. In fact, this year is going to be the last year we produce them. It's where the battle bridge is because most of our Galaxy-class ships have never had removable saucers. The ones with removable saucers, the bridge is actually deep inside the saucer, and then where the battle bridge is, that's not a battle bridge. The bridge is actually under that. That dome instead is a solid mass of defensive armament instead for the ones that separate. So there's a slight change in design. So this is, once again, where, technology has traversed over. The lifeboats, for example, are deleted. The lifeboat or life pods are in different locations on the hull. Those hatches, self-replicating torpedo launchers, is another example. And so we wanted to keep the problem we had with the Galaxy class for years was classifying what the hell it is. That, our variant, what we call this the core class variant. And the problem was we, for a while, because of the amount of firepower, we were calling them battle stars because they were pretty powerful. Then finally we settled on what we call battle cruisers. And unlike a normal battle cruiser, we don't use a designation BC. When we build a ship, we use the letters HBC for heavy battle cruiser, and then the letter G after it, Galaxy class. And then we have a hyphen, and then we have the serial number. Now, the serial number is part of the registry number. In the Murray Grove Agreement, one of the things we walked away with was that we would use the numbers 32 in front of all of our registry numbers. So when we put the NCC, we put the hyphen, and then we put 32 and then the serial number after. So I believe we're up to, I think, ship number 205, Damien, is building five at the moment. And those are going to be the last five in production. We're scheduled to phase the Galaxy class out in 2035, 2040. And then we're going to hopefully have a replacement design by then. Maybe they'll release a Titan kit or something, or one of the new designs that they've currently made, and we can replace it with that. That would be, you know, a nice thing to do. But go on.
What, you had mentioned about how a live action film had come about. When was that? And in your own view, I know you have an opinion on how it was adapted
on the date. Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's how that began. They did a World War II movie about the Yamato, the actual battleship Yamato. Okay, for those that don't know, space battleship Yamato, World War II battleship Yamato. They share the similar gun arrangement and deck design, but they differ in the sense that one's a spaceship and one's a naval warship that actually existed. There were three hulls successfully completed. They were the Yamato and the Musashi. Then the third hull was converted to an aircraft carrier called the Shinano. Unfortunately, they were all destroyed in World War II. Musashi sustained 9.5 hours of unrelenting aerial punishment. No warship in history has ever done that. The stats of the ordnance used on Musashi is underrated, under-exaggerated, not over. I talked to guys that survived that battle, and they basically said, we don't know how much ammunition we used.
Huh.
They just kept bombing the crap out of it for 9.5 hours. And then finally, the ship was so crippled, both the crew had helped to scuttle it, so it wouldn't be captured, and she was sinking anyway. They built these things in a way where they had an armored citadel. But, okay, so here's a problem with modern battleships. The New Jersey, for example. The New Jersey, Iowa, Missouri, and Wisconsin are all built the same. They're partly welded, but they're also, where their armor plate is in some areas, there's riveting. And everybody knows how the Titanic sunk, right?
Yeah.
It hit an iceberg, sheared some rivets off, and the equivalent total amount of an 8-foot hole is what sunk the ship. But it was, you know, when you add up all the rivet busts, okay, and plates that were bent, that's what sunk the ship. What sunk Yamato and Musashi was actually their own armor protection because it was riveted together. This is one of the reasons the Navy doesn't really want to reuse the Iowas anymore. Had they had successfully completed Kentucky and Illinois and then the following Montana-class battleships, they were going to be fully welded together in a way that the armor plate could be welded in place and easily fixed on the fly. They had actually come up with a way to do it. But the Iowa, New Jersey, Missouri, and Wisconsin, it's not just the overhead that costs them, okay? It's the fact that there is a weakness in the design. It's unfortunately an Achilles heel. They were well built. They could slug it out with another ship like they were designed to do, but and they did consider this when building the ships to help reduce the torpedo damage that could cause the rivets to break in key areas. So at least they were doing that. Whereas the Yamato and Musashi were built in the 30s, and they really didn't have that knowledge. The U.S. Navy learned this when they saw what happened at Pearl Harbor to some of their own battleships with torpedoes. And that's what made them think, let's change a few things. And they started going in the right direction. Unfortunately, the Iowas were the end of the line. But had battleships continued, they would be welded together today in super lift sections like aircraft carriers are built. So there's a little bit of history for you guys out there to learn about. And I encourage you to go visit the Battleship New Jersey and take a tour. It's a wonderful thing. When I visited, I didn't go for the normal tourist reasons. I went to see how I'm building my battleship models, because when I build them, I have full decks and compartments in them and bulkheads. And that's because if I'm at a display, Bob, if you call me up and say, hey, Ted, bring models, but there's no table space, but there's a pool, I can put the battleship in the pool, and I know it's not going to sink because it's got all these airtight compartments in it. And if it does take on water, well, when I drain it, it's still floating for one, and two, when I drain it, I can see where the hole is, and I can fix it later. You know?
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so I do that. I've been doing that for many years, since the 90s. You remember one of my former loves, her parents had a pool in the backyard, and we had a lot of ships and we didn't have a lot of space, so they never used their pool, so we used to park them in the water. And,
oh,
you know, that was on
that
would form over the cover. And we had this island in the middle, and we did that for years. So that's why I tell people when I build the models, I say 1 month equals a year, because if you leave the ship outside, it ages a year every month. And then in 2 years, it's 24 years old, just like a real ship, you know.
Yeah.
So to this day, I still work on them and maintain them like that. My overhead's gone down a lot, thanks to COVID especially. I don't have to do as much maintenance. And the reason I say maintenance is because when you call us up and say, hey, bring a display of models, that puts wear and tear on the model, because we're taking it out of its protective place.
Yeah.
And we're taking it out to the public. And so we have to do maintenance, and, you know, might be paint damage. Maybe a part broke off in transit. Maybe somebody picked it up and something broke. And we've experienced that before, where we've taken some of the models you've had fallen off.
Yeah.
And luckily I bring repair stuff and we fix them really quick. So, you know, that's an example of the overhead, some of the things we have to do. And it's part of the fun. It's part of the art, you know, and it helps teach you so that the next generation of kits is just as good. But back to our main subject, you know, I'm going to miss Lee Jai Matsumoto. I'm going to miss his storytelling. It's beautiful storytelling, kind of like Disney quality, you know, storytelling. And, you know, I hate to compare anime to Disney, but if I was to equate any kind of anime to Disney, it would be his stories as a positive equation, you know, because I think he really strove for quality storytelling in his story.
So he not only did the animation, he was also the writer of this, or was
he did a lot of writing. He did a lot of manga. Manga is the Japanese version of comic.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of manga out there. It was very beautifully done. His storytelling is just amazing. I mean, you know, if I got a choice of a Disney movie that's a really good story or the Space Battleship Yamato, I'm passing up the Disney movie. I'll pass up any movie, any show to watch Space Battleship Yamato. It's funny, my mom's sending my Blu-ray player and my Space Battleship Yamato movies out here to Arizona to me. So I'll be able to watch my Yamato animes. And it's all the new anime. I like the old stuff. I watch it on YouTube when I can catch it, you know. I'm not really into collecting the old anime because I like the newer stuff better. It's crisper, it's nicer, it's more, you know, detailed. Stories have actually enhanced quite a bit. In the reimagined series, instead of the Gamelons being the attackers, in the first meeting, the first contact with them, it's Earth forces that attack them. But they tell the people of Earth that it was the Gamelons that attacked them, and they don't tell them the truth. You find out in the first season.
Oh,
so
interesting.
Yeah, that's a spoiler alert for everybody. Sorry to do that, but I'm not going to tell you how it ends. It does follow the original story, so if you've seen the original story, you know how it ends. Then the next season, they got the Comet Empire. They've got a third season, which I believe is the Dark Nebula. I haven't gotten those yet. I plan on collecting them. They go by years. So the first season is $21.99, okay, for $2,199. And then $22.05 is the third season. So $22.02 is the Comet Empire series. And then $22.05 is, I believe, the Dark Nebula series. And from the video I've seen, the video I've looked up on YouTube is MAD AMV/AMV. Space Battleship Yamato. If you put that in, I believe the music from it is from 2205. It sounds beautiful. It's a wonderful video, and you get a nice idea that what it's based on. And from what I can tell, they're using the ships from the Dark Nebula series, which is good. Now, in Star Blazers, the third season was actually called the Bowler Wars with the Bowler Federation, or something like that, Bowler Alliance. I'm not sure how that really played out. I never got to see it in its entirety. There was another Space Battleship Yamato series also done that was kind of like a reimagined series, Space Battleship Yamato Resurrection. It takes place after the final Yamato movie called Final Yamato from the original genre series. They got some interesting ship designs and fights and that. You can find that on YouTube. Another one, unfortunately, never got to be finished was Yamato 2520, and it was about the 18th Yamato. I don't know if Lee Jai Matsumoto had anything to do with that because the ship design was very different. It was very too sleek for my taste. But it was a very good story. I mean, it was right on par with the stuff that he's done. There was another series called, I can't remember what it was called, Great Galactic Yamato or something like that, where they took the Yamato and kind of like, the design has like some Captain Harlock influences on it. I've caught clips of that on YouTube, but I've never seen the series in the entirety. And it would be interesting to see. So I don't know if he had any thing to do with that series, but the characters and everything, I think they use the same animators. And that's why the character designs are similar. So I don't know more about those series other than, you know, what was put out there. I don't know the premise of the bad guys or anything, you know, or how things got started. I just caught clips, basically, of episodes here and there where I can find them. I'm sure if I got on Tubi or something fully committed to Amazon Prime, maybe I could find a bunch more stuff, you know, or Hulu, for example. I know that Netflix is doing a live action Gundam series and, you know, I think they're starting to put some of the Gundam stuff on there, which eventually I hope to get back to Netflix once, I get some things taken care of.
I know it's always a challenge to translate, whether it be film or a live series, you know, an anime project to live action, because there's always that, you know, fans are
it's very hard. I'll give you an example. They did a live action Attack on Titan. Oh my God, it was a disaster. And the Japanese did this on their own. It was a complete disaster. The Space Battleship Yamato live action was well written, really good, but they kind of deviated from the origin story of the Gamelons and the Iskandarians, and so they kind of like shot themselves in the foot unintentionally, from my opinion, you know, as somebody that appreciates the series. So I'm not a big fan of the live action film, probably one of the few I'm not a big fan of because I had higher expectations. But
why do you think they did that?
Well,
why do you think they did
that in a second?
Because they couldn't really do as sophisticated as the CGI that we now have.
Bob, I think at the time they were in the process of wrangling back control of the rights. I'll give an example. Macross with Harmony Gold. Harmony Gold really, they created Robotech. And basically what they did was they took Macross, threw it up into the air, and shot it with a machine gun and put it back together and called it Robotech. And I hate the word Robotech because that's not what it is. They took three different series that were completely isolated and different from each other, the storylines, and created this Robotech crap. And, you know, yeah, it took off here really good in the United States. They lucked out. But overseas, it bombed. And a lot of Macross fans are overseas. If Americans that saw Robotech haven't seen Macross, they need to watch Macross because they're going to be like, oh, my God, they cut out all this good shit that's in the film. Sorry for the S word. And you've left us with garbage by comparison. Because I grew up on Robotech, then I watched Macross. Now, back to the live-action problem. I'm going to give an example of this. In the reverse, though, Masami Shiro, well-known Japanese manga artist, writer, and anime scriptwriter. They did Ghost in the Shell as a couple of series.
Yeah.
A lot of people that went and saw the Scarlett Johansson Ghost in the Shell were probably expecting like the standalone complex series with little blue tanks that would be running around, little blue spider tanks, making jokes and getting into trouble. And they were expecting the little comic reliefs. I bet that's what happened. What Masami Shiro did was he was totally involved in the project. He had to approve everything, every scene that was shot. Okay? It's not like what Hollywood normally did. And so what they did was they did it based on the original film that Masami Shiro was heavily involved in, the first Ghost in the Shell. And so I think a lot of fans were disappointed. They were expecting something else, and it was an origin story. It was meant to set the stage for follow-up stories later, which they could do.
Yeah.
Overseas, it did great. In the United States, it didn't do as good because, you know, people had different expectations here. Okay? And that happens, you know.
Yeah.
But it did do
I
fair.
I have not enjoyed the expectation because I wasn't familiar with it. And I kind of enjoyed it, you know.
It was well done, and I enjoyed it. It was very good. Mainly because they allowed Masami Shiro to have full control, basically over the scenes and everything. And the guys making the film were all Ghost in the Shell fans, which also helped. And I thought that was really good. So, and then Scarlett Johansson, she didn't take the job right away. She actually delayed their production because she went instead as a dry run to see if she could do it. Played the character Lucy in the movie Lucy.
Yeah.
That was,
I love that.
She admitted that in an interview. That was a dry run. And then she took the job for Motoko Kusanagi. And that was the other thing people were disappointed. They were like, well, it's a white chick playing an Asian girl. No. Motoko has a cyber body. She can be anything. She can even be in a guy's body. Her brain is organic, comes in an armored shell, and is designed to go from body to body. You could even put her in a Cylon Centurion, you know, Enterprise D for the computer system, for example. Because the human brain basically is, in life, a computer. Only in their world, it's cyber-enhanced. And hers, she has no organic body. She has a cybernetic body with a organic brain. Because that's all that's left of her. And the backstory and everything, that was great. I mean, I loved how they kind of changed it up a little bit from the original origin story. And so it gave it more meaning, I think. And it was great enjoying that film. And I love watching it when I can. I'm hoping in the next batch of films my mom sends me, she sends me that. Because I would love to sit there and watch it again.
What was the film that came out a little more recent, only a few years ago, and they enhanced the actress's eyes to be almost more animated or have that look?
Battle
and I forgot the name of it.
Another one. Oh my God, that they did really good with. That was beautifully done. Oh, that was really well done for live action. Yes. Yeah, okay, so that was a standalone film originally as an anime, and they set this up so that it could be sequel. And I hope they do a sequel. I think that would be great.
Yeah.
That
I enjoyed
beautiful
that one,
done.
Too.
Yeah, oh, I loved that. I think those are the best two adaptations, Ghost in the Shell and that, and then Space Battleship Yamato in that exact order. Actually, Alita would be first, then Ghost in the Shell, then Space Battleship Yamato. As for beautifully done live-action adaptations for anime, one of the worst adaptations that ever was done, and I hate to mention it, because I'm a big Dragon Ball Z fan. I love Dragon Ball Z. I always have. They did a live-action Dragon Ball Z. Oh, my God, it was horrid.
It was horrible. Yes.
The only person
I heard about it.
Yeah, the only person that made it worth watching actually went and watched Dragon Ball Z for his character was Chow Yun-Fat. He played Roshi, old man Roshi. And he went and actually watched the series to understand the character. And he played the character flawlessly. He was the only actor that carried that film that made it worth watching. There is another anime that was done in a live action. Five films total. Okay? And it was done in the tradition of the anime. So instead of trying to make it more realistic, it was done beautifully translated. Some of you are going to be familiar with Samurai X or Rurouni Kenshin. You need to watch the live-action films. I can't name them all off the top of my head, but if you look up Rurouni Kenshin live-action films, there are five of them, and you can look up the chronological order for them. If you watch them, oh, my God, they are beautifully done. One of the films called Tokyo Inferno, I remember this one, they have Shishiro. And they have a beautiful fight scene that's in tradition of true anime between all the good guys, basically, and anti-heroes, and Soshiro. I hope I got his name right. The lead bad guy. And it's really good. I mean, Bob, you would love it. I mean, these guys are all like, you know, I mean, it would be like, I can't think of anything in science fiction I could equate this to. So, you know, but as a live action done in as a period film, not science fiction, as like a period fantasy film, this would be number one, you know, for a series. Definitely. I would like to see them do more adaptations, others. I know they did a Bleach film. I did see that. It was decent. I would like to see other stories. Like, I don't know if they're doing a Naruto or if they have. I think Naruto would be good, for example, to follow that path. I would also like to see, they did a live-action Space and Harlock. It was okay. I didn't like how they changed the Arcadia, kind of like what they did with the Calvin Universe Enterprise. So I really wasn't thrilled with that, but the characters were very much on par, as well as the story. I would love to see somebody come along that could do a better adaptation for that. And I would love to see a Queen Esmeralda done in live action. I would love to see that. Or Galaxy Express, even. I know that fans out there for Robotech and Macross have been doing short live action YouTube videos, which have been really nicely done. I would love to see a live action Macross. I don't know who's sitting on the rights for that at the moment. I know that there's been rumblings that they want to do it because the computer technology is catch up so they could CGI a lot of stuff. But I would like to see a lot of Leiji Matsumoto's other stuff also converted to live action. But I would like it done right with directors and producers and scriptwriters who will really appreciate the stories and translate them correctly, not hash it together haphazardly, which is usually what happens with live-action anime, unfortunately, and that's what makes it really sucky to see those films, because it's like, come on, guys, you had the budget. You could have done a better job. Did you even watch the original stuff? You know, and half the time, 90% of the time, the producers and directors aren't even fans. They've never even watched it, you know?
I know. That's when it gets really terrible, when the people behind the scenes don't even know the material that they're playing with, or don't even take the time to do the research, whether it be comic books or literature or what have you.
And, Even in comics, we've seen the same thing happen in comics, Bob. We have. You know, the people, granted, lately, the people doing the comic, and they're trying their best to do good adaptations. My hat's off to them.
But Fantastic Four,
the guy,
you know, that was probably the worst. That sucked up all the life out of Fantastic Four.
I'm going to throw a plug out here for it's non-anime related. It's Star Trek based. I'm going to throw a plug out here for Frank. He is doing been doing a series called Farragut that was in the Prime universe of Star Trek and in the past, you know, the Kirk era, okay, the early Kirk era. Now he's doing one called Farragut Forward, which is the movie era. So if you guys can catch those on YouTube. They're nice episodes. All the sets are beautifully done. And the translation from past stuff to present, these are fans doing this, you know, writing, directing, and acting. And you can see the improvements over time with the episodes, how they're improving their acts of genres. Should be included, is my point about this. Should be included in the genre to help the directors and producers produce something that's fan-friendly. Okay, not do a thing like what Disney did, for example, to Gina Carano because she had personal opinions that didn't include or affect Disney, but yet they decided to fire her via social media and then get sued for it instead of, you know, through traditional means, which they should have done. You know, and every state has what do they call that? You know, where they protect your employee rights and things. Yeah, they were on her side when she sued them. Carano is actually a Star Wars fan, it turns out. You know, of course she's not going to badmouth her own show, you know, or her character. She had a political opinion, and people that were politically sensitive at Disney decided to trash can her in the most insensitive and impolite way you could and wasn't legal to do, terminated because of this, you know. And there was, you know, contract violations. So when I look at Star Trek, for example, look at Star Trek, for example, for a while they were going after the fans, and then I believe it was CBS who holds all the rights told Paramount, no, you're not, and basically stepped in and said, you know, as long as they're not violating certain things, they can continue to produce stuff. But I would like to see more than that. I would like to see studios actually reach out to fan groups that are doing these kind of things and include them in projects to help enhance the projects and get feedback on what the fans are thinking.
Yeah, I would think that would be such a natural step to, you know, use them as a test audience or get some feedback.
Right. And that was the nice thing when they did even the sequel Star Wars films, they included a lot of fans, 501st, people from the 501st. You know, Daniel Craig, the actor, was a stormtrooper.
Yeah.
He was playing the stormtrooper in the one scene where Rey is tied up in that chair in that cell. And that's him in that stormtrooper armor. Yeah, that's pretty cool. And you know, I never knew Daniel Craig, James Bond, was a Star Wars fan. He wanted in on that. I guarantee he didn't get paid crap for it, but he didn't care. He was in Star Wars. That's what mattered.
Yeah, exactly.
And I would love to do stuff with Star Trek or anime, like a live-action anime. I would love to be in that, you know, as a fan. Because I write my own stuff for fun as a hobby, as you know, we've talked about some of that, and I love to write. I have a nice story I have finished for fun, where my character lives in the DC universe for about 5,000 years, and the story is myself in that universe, and but he travels other universes, you know. So I haven't gotten around to adding other things yet. But I am translating them over to the other story you and I want to work on. That's a Star Trek one. And he's going to be in that universe for a while from the DC universe, because he's gone from our reality to DC and then to Star Trek. He's been to other universes, and in the story, in his office, he has memorabilia from every universe. So, like, you know, he'll have, like, Mandalorian armor or blasters, or, you know, maybe models of ships and things, or movie posters from our universe, from some of those genres.
Exactly what we would do with our topic universes.
Yeah, because I would like, you know, because you never know, I might be in that universe and somebody's filming it and say, hey, look, I'm promoting everybody. Because I love all of it. You know, I'm one of those people that I would love to see a massive crossover show where they go out and get people from different genres and bring them in. And Star Trek's the perfect platform for that. And I'm surprised Paramount, CBS have not thought of this sooner. Because if they would think of this, you know, bring characters in from, let's say, the Marvel Universe. You don't want them to overshadow the show, so you're not going to have them use all their superpowers. Maybe they're just trapped there for a little bit and are just trying to find their way home, and then, boom, you find an anomaly, and, oh, wow, there they go, through the wormhole. They're home.
I think
the beauty of Star Trek.
Unfortunately, I think the beam counters get too much involved in this to try to divide up, well, what would be our share, our studio share, as opposed to, you know. They can't just.
Well, I think what they should do is if they ever do it, I think what they, because I'm going to give you a character from DC, or no, from Marvel that has been to the DC universe, Deadpool. He's traveled universes, and this has been done in the comics. And I can't wait to see how they're going to figure that out to do it in live action, because at some point they're going to do it. And I think what they're going to do is both studios are going to come together and do it as a team effort. And it'll be like a limited thing. And that I could see happening, in which case the budget would be astronomical. I got to say, James Cameron, eat your heart out, because you're not going to make as much money as that film will. Your Avatar film.
We did see The Predator and Aliens together. It would be great to see, say, Terminator and RoboCop, the original RoboCop together. And
Terminator versus Terminator and Aliens versus Terminator. All those could be brought together. It has been talked about. It was, in the script phase at one point, but it never materialized because at the time there was a lot of other things going on. And people have – this is another thing we got to remember, guys, out there as fans. Studios have lots of projects going on. And they can't get to everything, unfortunately. And as much as I would love to see animes brought to life. Yeah. As much as I would love to see some animes brought to life, unfortunately, that may never happen. You know, one of the animes I'd love to see, which is not related to Lee Jai Matsumoto, I'd love to see a live-action adaptation of Akira. I actually believe Leonardo DiCaprio is sitting on the rights to that.
Yeah, I know
I'd love to see him do something with it.
There was talk about that for a while. But that's
I think some of the issues had to do with budget availability and the fact he had other projects going on. And I also think it had to do with the CGI technology wasn't there yet to do it. It might be doable now. He might decide to do it if he can get somebody to help carry it, like Netflix, for example. So there was, you know, also the marketing issue. But if he does control the rights, I'm hoping that he will do something with it, and I'm sure he will if he can. You know,
well, that's the exciting thing about this too, is that by going the streaming series route, you know, you might have more episodes, more time to delve into things as opposed to a 2-hour or even a 3-hour movie. You know, it might do well or better. Like I think Disney took a big hit with John Carter of Mars. Well, one is because they marketed terribly, but if that property was kind of made into a streaming service, you know, with that could actually use some of the adult material and things like that, and could really delve into, because it's a very long book series.
Oh, yeah.
Even,
well, I do believe that they are planning a sequel for that. I think it's in the script writing phases right now, last I read. I don't know how far they've gotten. I don't know if it's going to go through. I mean, they could have shelved it. Who knows?
Yeah, I know. It got a bad rap, and I know they were originally, they had high hopes to do.
I know that
you
Warner Brothers did whatever merger they did recently, I know that they shelved a bunch of stuff, including Henry Cavill's Superman. They shelved Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman 3 temporarily, or for the moment. Hopefully they'll bring it back, you know, because they're still using Gal Gadot for stuff, which is a good sign. They haven't cut her out, unlike Henry Cavill, who was the first part. They almost lost Henry Cavill because when they did the the Superman series, or no, it was Supergirl, and they were introducing Superman. They cast somebody else to be Superman, and it really pissed him off. Because he was willing to do it, and he didn't care about the pay. He wants the character. I mean, look, he was doing the Witcher series for a while. Now they've, you know, gotten rid of him from that. And I was like, that's a mistake. But he left because there was creative differences. He didn't like where they were going to take the character.
I hate to interrupt, but we have around 3 minutes left. So start sharing contact info.
Oh, wow.
Time flies,
Bob, when we're having fun.
That's how it always
goes,
Dad.
We have to do this again.
Yes, absolutely. Well,
thank you all for having me on. I really appreciate it. I hope the audience did as well.
Our pleasure.
I appreciate your knowledge in this area, Ted. I, of course, can be reached at USSChallenger.org and through Facebook at USSChallenger and beamaboard@AOL.com. And I look forward to our next installment.
People can reach me at Ted Athanasio on Facebook or Instagram. So
you better spell your last name so they know.
Oh, Athanasio.
Okay.
And they can always reach me through you too. So
absolutely. Yep.
So thank you
to
both of you for an excellent show. Bob, you and I will speak about the project that I told you about on the phone, I guess, one day. And how can people reach you? You are the commander. You are the admiral. You are Regent 7.
Well, like you said, beam aboard's easy enough at AOL.com. I can always be found on our Facebook page, USS Challenger, Region7.com, and Starfleet Region 7 has a Facebook page as well. And, of course, the USSChallenger.org is my chapter's website. So there's multiple ways to reach me, and I'm always up for contact. Would love to hear from you both.
Hey, Bob, give me a call when you're done.
Thank you both. And thanks to our wonderful audience. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called in you're patiently waiting in our queue, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand, until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Good night, everybody, and thanks again.
Thank you.
Good night. Thanks.